We've been working through the first bit of Matthew's Gospel over the past few weeks, and today we come to Matthew 2, 19 to 23. Fong is going to read that passage to us.
The reading today is taken from Matthew chapter 2, verse 19 to 23, and that can be found on page 974 of the Church Bible. It's Matthew chapter 2, starting from verse 19 on page 974. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, Rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene.
Do you sit down? We're going to be looking at that passage we had read. So if you've got it there in front of you, do keep it open. Page 974. And these white sheets will be a help as well. That's the season to be jolly. That's probably a song that we've heard on the radio or sung lately. We know that Christmas is a time of celebration, time of joy, goodwill, peace. But actually, the reality is, and this is something we're going to reflect on a little bit today, is that for a lot of people, Christmas doesn't feel like much of a joyful time. In fact, I don't know if you're a fan of the band U2, as I am, but they sing a song about how this Christmas message of peace is hard for them to swallow as they look around at the reality of sadness and suffering in our world. So they wrote this song that goes like this. Jesus, in the song you wrote, the words are sticking in my throat. Peace on earth. Hear it every Christmas time. But hope and history won't rhyme. So what's it worth, this peace on earth? And for some of us, that idea might resonate with us. You know, peace and goodwill sounds like a brilliant idea. But how is Christmas good news to so many in our world who are hurting and suffering? You know, perhaps those here in this room for whom Christmas makes us very aware of our own sadnesses, our grief, our loneliness, our depression, whatever it might be. And also, how is Christmas good news for those in the worst trouble spots in our world? Baroness Caroline Cox is the former Deputy Speaker of the House of Lords, and she personally supervises Christian relief to many of the worst war-torn areas of the world. And she describes on one occasion what it was like to enter a Sudanese village after the government-backed soldiers had just left. She said this, "The stench of death was simply overpowering. More than 100 corpses lay where they'd been butchered. Men, women, children were being carried north as slaves. Straw huts set ablaze. And worst of all was the knowledge that the militia would return." So the question we're thinking about is, how is the good news of Christmas good news in that kind of situation? Well, this passage we're looking at, Matthew 2, we've been working our way through this section of Matthew 2 over the last three slots, and these verses describe the events all around the birth of Jesus. And the punchline of our passage, if you've got it open, is in those final six words. It says this, "He," which is Jesus, "shall be called a Nazarene." Now, I know for a lot of us that's going to need a little bit of unpacking, but what Jesus being a Nazarene means, and this is the main point of our verses today, there on the sheets, it means that God chooses to be amongst the downtrodden. So let's look at the passage together. And our section begins with Joseph, Mary and Jesus. They're refugees in Egypt. They've fled there to escape from Herod's massacre. That's where we left them on Sunday. But then, verse 19, when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead." And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. Now, many of us, I guess, would love that kind of direct angelic guidance in life, telling us what to do, where to go, and it would make life a lot simpler. But this direct guidance which Joseph receives here is for a very special purpose. God is making sure that Jesus, this child who's been promised for centuries, the promised one, will be brought up in Israel in preparation for what is to come. But there's more, verse 22. But when he, Joseph, heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. So in these verses, God sends another miraculous dream. And he does it to make sure that Jesus grows up in exactly the place of God's choosing. A place, in fact, which fulfills ancient prophecy. Now, interestingly, if you are so inclined and you do a word search to find out which prophecy in the Bible, which Old Testament prophecy is being fulfilled here, there's no reference in the whole Old Testament to the promised one being called a Nazarene. But actually, if you look closely at verse 23, unlike all the other places where Jesus is said to fulfill a prophecy, in this one he's said to fulfill what was spoken by the prophets, plural. So the point is that this prediction, he shall be called a Nazarene, is actually a summary of lots of different prophecies about Jesus. And Nazarene simply stands for, it's shorthand for, someone who is despised. If you know the Bible, you might know that this is what Nathanael said to Philip in John chapter 1 when he was told that he'd found the Christ and that he was Jesus of Nazareth. And he said to him, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" And then after the resurrection, when the opponents of Christianity wanted to label the Christians in a kind of sneering, put-down way, they called them in Acts 24, that Nazarene sect. So this idea of being a Nazarene, it's effectively racist. It would be like calling someone today a pikey or a gypsy. It's a term of abuse about a person's origins. So the point is that God goes to all this trouble in this passage, and he sends not just one, but two miraculous dreams to Joseph. And he does it to make sure that he grows up in exactly the place of God's choosing. And that place is on a trailer park amongst the despised nobodies of Jesus' day. That's the punchline here. God chooses to be amongst the downtrodden. And this isn't just for a convenient photo shoot. Like when a politician makes sure he's caught on camera visiting the orphanage, you know, the day before the election. No, for 90% of the time that the saviour of the world was on this planet, he spent the time amongst the poor, in absolute obscurity, in a place not even referred to in the Old Testament, and a place that people scoffed at when it was even mentioned. Now, there's every opportunity here for the preacher for a cheap joke where I say something like Nazareth was backward and despised, a little bit like, and then fill in the blank place is today. But because it's Christmas, there's visitors, and I don't know where everyone's from, I thought it would be safest just to leave you to fill in the blank yourself. When Jesus did eventually leave Nazareth, the elite in the society, they just refused to take him seriously. He didn't go to the right college or come from the right place. He had these rough tradesman's hands, he had a thick provincial accent, he was always hanging out with the wrong sorts of people, and it was just obvious that Jesus didn't tick the right boxes. And I've put on the sheets three implications of this amazing truth that we see in our passage today, that God chooses to be amongst the downtrodden. And the first one is, he knows our pain. There's an anonymous poem which I guess lots of us will have read. It's written in the last century, called The Long Silence. And the poem describes how, at the end of time, billions of people are scattered on this great plain, gathered actually before God's throne. And most of the people who are there, they shrink back from the throne, from the brilliant light before them. But some of the groups on that plane, they start talking, not with hushed tones and with shame, but with anger and belligerence. Can God judge us? How can he know about suffering? Snaps one girl who had been tortured in a Nazi concentration camp. And in another group, a boy shows a rope burn on his neck. What about this, he says, lynched for no crime but being black. And in another group, a pregnant schoolgirl says, why should I suffer? It wasn't my fault. And across the plain, there are hundreds of these groups having these conversations, each of them with a different complaint against God for the evil and the suffering that he's permitted on this earth. How lucky God was to live in heaven, where there was no weeping, no fear, no hunger, no hatred. What did God know of all that people had, been forced to endure in this world? And so each of these groups, they sent forth their leader, chosen because they'd suffered the most. And in the centre of this vast plain, they consulted with each other. And at last they were ready to present their case. Before God could be qualified to be judge, he must endure what they had endured. God should be sentenced to live life on earth as a man. Let him be born as a Jew. Let the legitimacy of his birth be questioned. Give him a work so difficult that even his family will think him out of his mind. Let him be betrayed by his closest friends. Let him face false charges. Let him be tried by a prejudiced jury and convicted by a cowardly judge. Let him be tortured. And at last, let him see what it means to be terribly alone. Then let him die, so that there can be no doubt that he died. And as each leader announced this portion of the sentence, loud murmurs of approval went up from the throng. And when at last they'd finished pronouncing the sentence, there was a long silence. And no one uttered a word. No one moved. Suddenly everyone knew that God had already served his sentence. And the point of the story is obvious, isn't it? Amongst all the various gods, all the various religions of this world, the true God is alone. He's unique. He is not distant. He's not aloof. He is the one who knows our pain. So we began by asking, how is Christmas good news for those who are hurting? And the first part of the answer is that these verses reveal to us a God who understands, a God who cares. But that's not all. He doesn't just know our pain. Secondly, there on the sheets, he takes our shame. Now, when Matthew says in these verses that Jesus fulfills what was spoken by the prophets in verse 23, Matthew is reminding us, his readers, of lots of the Psalms which speak of the Christ as the one who would be scorned by mankind and despised by the people. But I think particularly Matthew seems to have in mind the description in the prophet Isaiah 700 years before Jesus of the suffering servant, the one in Isaiah 53 who would be despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. But why? Why this prediction about this one who would come and be despised and rejected? And the answer is in the following verses. Isaiah continues in that chapter. So he says, despised and rejected by men, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes, we are healed. So do you see the point? God didn't choose here to be amongst the downtrodden and the afflicted, and just to be with us, just to hold our hands, or nice though that might be. Here we see that Jesus came to take our shame upon himself. In 2009, Bernie Madoff, famously, he went from being this multimillionaire to earning a few pence an hour doing prison labour. And that kind of come down that you read about, it doesn't even come close to the sort of come down that Jesus took here by choice. You see, as the Son of God, Jesus always occupied the position of the highest imaginable eminence in the whole universe, worshipped and served by countless angels. And yet here we see the Son of God becoming flesh. But actually, even that step was only just the beginning of a long spiral downwards through homelessness and poverty and exhaustion, humiliation, pain, through Jesus' agonies in Gethsemane and finally to the cross. The verse we began our service with says this: though Jesus was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor, so that we, by his poverty, might become rich. Do you see, God chooses to be amongst the downtrodden in this world for a reason. It's so that he can take our shame. And that is why Christmas is good news, wonderful news for any in this world who are hurting. You see, Jesus restores us to our Creator so that we can look forward to a renewed creation without pain, without tears, enjoying God forever. And whatever struggles we might have here, that is truly the best possible news in the world. But there's more. As we close, not just he knows our pain, he takes our shame, but thirdly, and this is the heading which is slightly forced, he also redefines gain. So the point is that in choosing to be amongst the downtrodden, Jesus redefines what is truly valuable, what is truly gain in this world. Three chapters after this, Jesus, the one we're told here, the Nazarene, the despised one, he begins his teaching ministry with these words. He says this: they're unlike anything this world has ever heard. Blessed are the poor in spirit. So Jesus grew up in this area where lots of people had broken spirits. And Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. God's blessing, Jesus says, comes on those who acknowledge that they're spiritually bankrupt. It comes on those who say to God, I'm a nobody. I've got nothing to bargain with you. I depend entirely on your mercy and your grace. And to those people, Jesus says, are given as a gift the kingdom of heaven. This future inheritance with God that lasts forever. So Jesus redefines what is truly precious. As the Bible says elsewhere, let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation. Has not God chosen those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom? If we have this treasure, if we have the certain hope of enjoying our great God in this renewed universe which he promises, if we have this treasure, then whatever our circumstances might be, whatever challenges we might face, the reality is that we are truly blessed. Baroness Cox, who I began with, she went on to describe what happened next in that Sudanese village. So the raiders had gone and they'd left the results of their cruelty all around her. Husbands slain, children kidnapped, homes ruined, the women brutalised. And the few women who were still alive were pulling themselves together. And their first instinctive act was to make tiny little crosses, crude crosses out of wood, sticks that were just lying on the ground. And they were pushing them into the earth. You might think, what were they doing? Were they making memorials, perhaps, of those they'd just lost? But they weren't. Baroness Cox explains that these crude little crosses were not grave markers. They were symbols of hope. At that moment of utter desperation, those crossed sticks pressed into the ground were little acts of faith. As followers of Jesus, these women knew that they served a God who chose to be amongst the downtrodden. A God who was himself nailed to a cross, and they who knew pain just like they knew pain. And so there they were, blinded by pain and grief themselves, and horribly aware that the world would never know and probably never care about their plight. And still they stake their lives on the conviction that there is one who knows and who cares, and that they're not alone. So how is Christmas good news for those who are hurting? Well, whatever challenges we and those around us might be facing this Christmas time, Christmas really is the best news in the world, because it reveals to us a God who chooses to be amongst the downtrodden and the afflicted, a God who knows our pain, a God who takes our shame, and a God who redefines what is real gain. May we rejoice in him this Christmas day. We're going to sing again and rejoice together in this God. So let's stand and sing, "It Came Upon the Midnight Clear."